Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mowell, and as always, I am joined by my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all. I have a cat on my lap.
Statement of fact.
Yes. So no soundboard, at least at the beginning, because I'm not at my computer.
Oh. I could improvise with whatever objects I find near me on the desk.
There you go.
We'll make that happen.
We had a weird musical instrument toy once, one of our earlier episodes. Can't remember what it was.
Oh, yeah. Was that the one that I got in the Hmong market in the cities?
Sounds, yeah. I remember it was kind of an exotic instrument. Yeah,
it's like, yeah, it's like a little pan flute, but it has I don't know what to call it other than a sphere in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm, that sounds about right.
Yep, I am blanking on the name, but I'm not gonna look it up because we don't do that stuff around here.
Do you still have it?
Yeah, I do.
Nice.
I never learned to play it, but sometimes I haul it out and just make annoying sounds for fun.
Nice. Bet Sarah appreciates that.
Yes. I feel like a good chunk of her being married to me is just putting up with strange noises and random little songs that I invent.
Fun stuff. Poor Sarah.
Yeah, poor Sarah. Poor Sarah.
Poor Sarah.
Not poor Sarah. We were starting to talk about something before we hit record that you wanted to expound on, Jack. So I will let you introduce the topic.
Yes. So somehow the topic of South Park came up, and Ben mentioned how they've been on a real hot streak of social commentary recently. And he didn't have a chance to define how recently he meant or for how long, but that brought to mind a topic that we have discussed briefly before, which is that South Park, they did switch to being more timely with their episodes, like where an episode would be about something in the news that week. They started like really focusing on that strategy maybe back like 2010, 2011, somewhere around there. It's like, and I don't know if, according to what you said, Ben, it sounds like they've kept that up. I haven't really kept up with the newer episodes because I don't really have a way of watching them right now, ever since I moved to Iowa. But I agree that when the episode releases, it might be really funny and really timely. But the downside is that the episode ages really fast because it's so specific to an event that happened that week, which South Park can do because it only takes them a week to develop an episode from start to finish.
Right.
Whereas shows like Family Guy or The Simpsons, they're working for months on a single episode and they're working on multiple episodes at once. So that's something that South Park can do. And I think it's a good idea if they do it every now and then. But the downside with always doing it is that you don't get, or you're less likely to get what I always consider to be the classic episodes, like the World of Warcraft episode, the Scientology episode. There's the episode where they're kind of role playing as those anime characters. And Butters takes a ninja star in the eye.
Uh-huh.
So you don't get a lot of those because the episodes are so specific to something that, you know, a couple years from then is just going to be like old hat and, oh, wow, like they really didn't, you know, that's not really what they were predicting would happen is not what happened, and it just doesn't have the same zing. Plus, when things are so timely, it is so politically charged that you're going to alienate half your audience. Whereas if it's something that's timeless, it could be something kind of just really stupid, like the Loch Ness Monster trying to get $3.50 or Tree Fitty off of Chef's parents and keeps trying to scam them. You know, that's not politically charged. It's not social commentary. It's just something stupid, but it's hilarious.
Yeah.
And you're going to get less of that. So I'm not in favor of the strong focus they've had towards timely issues. So I just wanted to voice that opinion.
Yeah. That is a valid opinion. Because it's an opinion.
Mm. Are all opinions valid?
What do you mean? I was just wondering that. I was like, wait, are there invalid opinions?
But what defines a valid opinion? Like, what makes it valid? Just that it is an opinion?
An
opinion could be anything.
I mean, I guess, like, if a judge issues an opinion, right, a formal opinion, that could be valid or invalid.
What if, like, an opinion, somebody's opinion is something that's wrong? Like, in my opinion, the sky is red. Or in my opinion, maybe something even more quantifiably wrong, because we don't know how other people's brains interpret color. In my opinion, our solar system has two suns. It's pretty blatantly wrong. Is that a valid opinion or not? I would say no.
I mean, it's not really an opinion. It's just an incorrect fact.
Okay, so where do we differentiate opinions and facts, incorrect or otherwise? Because there was something...
An opinion...
In King of the Hill, Peggy Hill does this a lot. Well, she'll say, not a lot, but she does it multiple times, and she does similar things frequently as well, where she will say something like, in my opinion, practicing something is the best way to, you know, to get better at it. And it's like, that's not an opinion. That's just standard common knowledge, where she attests common knowledge as her opinion. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. To me, opinion is a statement of preference or a stance on something, which there isn't a right or wrong answer to.
Okay.
So, like, green is my favorite color, or green is the best color, right? Saying green is the best color is an opinion, because there's not a right or wrong answer. It's my opinion that it's the best color. Your opinion could be that red is the best color, right? But there's not a scientifically verifiable best color out there.
Well, it is green, but I think I see,
yes.
I think I see your point.
Yeah. So, I don't know. I think where you start to get a little more muddy is on things like, even on, say, a complex issue like, should the U.S. support Ukraine with military resources, right? Something like that. There isn't a right or wrong answer. There's pros and cons of both directions, right? But there's not a single correct answer. So I think even something like that, whatever position you take is still an opinion, because there's no way of confirming if you are right or not.
I see. So then what makes an opinion valid? Assuming that, like, when somebody says something and we say, yes, the statement that they made is, by the definition you just laid out, is an opinion, then what differentiates an invalid opinion from a valid one?
I mean, I would say an invalid opinion, like saying the Earth has two suns, an invalid opinion would be like something similar to saying the Earth has two suns, where it's verifiably false. So it's like, well, that's my opinion. It's like, no, it's just wrong.
Okay. So an invalid opinion at least one definition of an in or manifestation of what makes an opinion invalid is if they're saying their opinion is something that is factually incorrect, verifiably incorrect.
Yeah, or if they're misrepresenting something which can be factually verified as an opinion.
What about when, like the Peggy Hill example, where they're saying a fact is their opinion, right? Because you said an opinion is more like when there isn't an explicit right or wrong. You can take sides and say side B is the best option for X, Y, and Z reasons, because that's how you prioritize things. But if somebody said, in my opinion, our solar system only has one sun, it's like, that's not an opinion. So that to me also seems like an invalid opinion in that it's not an opinion.
Yeah. It's kind of like any scenario in which you are representing a position which could be verified or falsified as an opinion is invalid.
I never would have thought of somebody saying, like, in my opinion, and then they state a fact as an invalid opinion. But now that we talk about it, I'm okay with doing that, because when people do that, it is annoying. Like when Peggy Hill does it on numerous occasions, then it is very, it strikes me immediately as they just think they're trying to make themselves seem smart, or they think themselves are really smart.
Yeah, yeah. I would say in common usage, or at least in my experience, the phrase invalid opinion is typically just used for, it's used to mean bad opinions, I guess I would say. So like things that maybe there's not a truly right or wrong answer, but people are heavily favor one side over the other. Or choosing one side makes you seem dull or obtuse in some way.
Like if someone were to say, in my opinion, I think world hunger is, let's keep it around.
Yeah. That's one example.
I mean, it is an opinion if you think that world hunger is actually a good thing. I would agree that that's an opinion. But I wouldn't go so far to, like, I wouldn't call that an invalid opinion. I'd call it a cruel opinion. And a very revealing opinion, but I wouldn't call it I wouldn't jump to calling it an invalid opinion.
Or like saying that, my opinion, oatmeal, it's just too spicy.
I wouldn't even call that an invalid opinion.
No?
If they think it's spicy, then... boy, howdy, do I feel for them. And I'd be opt to calling them a flavor pansy, but.
I mean, if you can't handle the spice level of oatmeal, what on earth would you eat?
Of oats and cream. Yeah.
You're like, oh, I just drink water. I honestly feel like water's spicier than oatmeal. That's saying something.
Yeah. I mean, oatmeal has often has cream or milk in it, which is used to counteract spiciness. So it's anti-spicy, right, if anything. So maybe actually it is invalid in that way, because oatmeal, I guess you can always add spiciness to oatmeal. Like, I love my oatmeal with cayenne pepper and sriracha, which sounds disgusting.
But in that case, I would say that the opinion is valid, that the oatmeal is too spicy.
Yeah, in that case, I think we both agree that's a valid opinion. We may not agree ourselves, depending on the level of spice. But the question is when they don't add capsaicin. So maybe if we could, determine, and I think common sense is enough to determine, well, it's not spicy because there's zero capsaicin in it. So maybe in that sense, it is invalid because they're saying this, they're effectively saying this oatmeal has too much capsaicin in it, even though it doesn't have any. Now, somebody could say, well, maybe that means they need negative capsaicin, or like the counter agent of capsaicin in it for it just to be neutral to them. But I mean, now we're really starting to get into ridiculous hypotheticals here. Yeah.
I mean, it seems like the realm where we truly shine is ridiculous hypotheticals, but
would you agree to say that the counter agent or like the antithesis of capsaicin is mint? So menthol, maybe.
No, I would not say that.
You would not say that. Okay.
No.
That you said that pretty like you came in gunning, like you have an opinion there, pun intended.
Because I've actually thought about it a little bit. I think, like to me, I guess it depends on how you find it, but I think they use the same, like physiological effect, I guess. It's just the sensation is the opposite.
Right.
So I guess, and on one hand, if you're just talking about sensation of like one makes you feel hot, the other one makes you feel cold, okay, then yes, I would agree they're the opposite. But I think they're actually very similar in terms of their mechanics. So I feel like, no, there'd have to be something else happening to make it a truly anti-capsaicin flavor.
This, you know, this brings up an interesting conversation my friend and I had a few years back. So using the capsaicin versus menthol discussion, it seems to me that a, you know, valid approach to asking or to finding the answer to the question of what is the antithesis to capsaicin, that if one were to say, well, if capsaicin tricks your brain into thinking that some part of your body that it's touching is hot, then the antithesis to that would be something that tricks your brain to thinking it's cold, which is mint. It's menthol. So ergo, menthol is the antithesis to capsaicin. And it seems like that's a valid approach. And I wouldn't disagree with that statement. But I think where your point comes in, Ben, is that it's not like if you eat a chili pepper and, oh crap, my mouth's on fire, I need to get rid of this capsaicin, I need to like cool off my mouth. It's not like if you eat a bunch of mint that the spiciness is going to go away. It's just that now you're going to be feeling that this weird mixture of hotness and coolness in your mouth at the same time. And they don't actually counteract each other.
I think eating mint with like an already spicy mouth, I think it would actually make it worse.
Yeah, it could.
Because it's just like more stimuli on those nerves.
Right. So this brings up the conversation I had with my friend, where I can't remember what brought it up. But and this is my friend Jesse back in the cities. Jesse, if you're listening, then you know you're gonna laugh you're gonna recall this conversation.
This is a shout out to Jesse.
Yes, shout out to Jesse. So I can't remember what spurned it on. I think it was me who asked the question, but it could have been
spurred?
Jesse.
Spurred?
What did I say?
Spurned?
Oh yeah, it didn't spurn the question. It did the opposite of that.
It did the opposite, yes.
What is the exact opposite of an adjective?
Oh, we've talked about this before.
Right.
Was it offline though, or did we do it in an episode?
I don't remember doing it in an episode, but I won't go into the full details unless we want to, in which case I'd be very happy to, but also I don't remember all of them. But it was like and what I meant by the exact opposite, I mean, you really break down what is an adjective at like the base level. So it's something that describes a noun. It's a word, and quote, an adjective isn't in itself singular. So, okay. So the thing has to not be a word. It can't be singular. So it has to be plural, you know, like really breaking this down. And we through our machinations concluded that the exact opposite of an adjective is a series of silent instances. And so bringing that same ridiculous thought pattern to what is the exact opposite of capsaicin, what would it be? It wouldn't be menthol, because menthol is, like capsaicin, a chemical. And it's not just a chemical. It's a chemical that causes like this physiological trick, like sensation. And not only that, but right. It's also temperature mimicry. So they're actually really not opposites. They're very similar. So what would right. be, I mean, we can, I'd love to get into this right now, or maybe we can have Jesse on as a guest. Maybe we'll do that. Ooh, maybe I'll reach out to him.
I feel like we're on a roll here. We should finish this out. And then if there's other things we want to compute the exact opposite of, we could continue the discussion.
That's true. So we could do a part two with Jesse. So I agree. I'm on a roll now. So what, Ben, would the exact opposite of capsaicin be?
Well, we're already boxed into a corner because you mentioned that it's a chemical. And the list of things that aren't a chemical is small.
Well, you're right, right? Because, I mean, really anything is a chemical. So I think for...
A vacuum.
But here's the thing. If you were to say that because capsaicin is a chemical, then the thing that's the exact opposite of it must not be a chemical. But the problem is everything except a vacuum is a chemical. I guess light isn't a chemical. Like electromagnetic radiation isn't a chemical because it actually uses subatomic mm-hmm. particles. So maybe there's something there. But the point I'm trying to make is if everything in existence shares this characteristic, then it's not a characteristic that we have to bother finding the opposite of, because there is no option. You have a set.
Well, there's not an option within the real universe.
Sure. But let's stick with the real universe.
Yeah. Okay.
Make it more interesting that way. So sure, everything's a chemical by kind of definition, but
actually to that previous point, if you started by saying whatever it is, so like adjective or capsaicin is an object in the known universe, the opposite of it would start with being an object in an unknown universe or an imaginary universe.
That's
and
true.
Then you would go from there.
But because everything that we're, I think the assumption is that it's something that is here on Earth.
Yeah.
Or not, you know, in our universe. Because otherwise it's no fun. Because then you can say it's some weird alien thing that nobody's heard of before and it's not as interesting.
So you could argue that, it's a chemical. It tricks your brain into feeling a sensation of heat. So you could argue that, like, I mean, a vacuum, it's not directly the opposite of that, but it doesn't do those things.
Right.
Even like electromagnetic waves, unless they're in sufficient dosage or quantity, don't do those things. But then if they do, it would be a real sensation at that point.
Right.
You would be getting bombarded by electromagnetic waves. So.
Well,
particles.
And it makes you feel hot. So I think the opposite needs to involve cold in some sense.
So what if it's radiating, like being exposed to a vacuum where your body is really radiating heat into the environment?
It's not a chemical. And is really, yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's a real thing, not a chemical.
Boom. It doesn't trick your brain. And it actually makes you lose, or it actually affects your temperature rather than just tricks you into thinking that your temperature is being affected. And it does so in the opposite way, cold versus hot. Okay, you might be on a roll here. I feel like a vacuum is sort of like the opposite of everything. It could be the opposite of everything, though. It's sort of like a kernel in the mathematical sense. Where everything kind of funnels down to this one same thing. It's not as interesting.
Well, I mean, you can take it in a different direction if you feel like we've missed a branch on the possibility tree.
Well, it's, well, hold on. We have lots of, let's go down the list of characteristics. So capsaicin, it tricks your brain into thinking that you're hot wherever it touches. Okay. So
that's, Wait, hold on 1 second. What if it tricked your brain into thinking you were hot, like physically attractive?
Ooh.
So you eat hot peppers. You're like, boy, am I good looking.
That's right. Our society doesn't need any more help in that regard. Okay, so it tricks your brain to think that you're hot. And we can maybe even, as we did with the vacuum, break that into individual characteristics. Like it tricks your brain and hot, you know. It increases the temperature, at least what you're perceiving. So it could be something like the vacuum where it doesn't trick your brain and then it somehow involves cold, which I actually like that breakdown. Capsaicin is, I believe it's an oil. Isn't it? Or is that not? You know,
I mean, it's plausible. I'll say yes.
I think maybe I'm misspoken, but I think maybe it's in the oil. In oil, like it's natural, soluble, oil based, yeah. But it itself may not be an oil; it's probably like a powder. But
sure,
I think it's a solid, like at room temperature. So I would say the opposite of a solid is probably, a gas or plasma.
But or nothing,
or nothing. Because if the opposite of a gas is a solid, and the opposite of a solid is a gas, then what's the opposite of a liquid? Would it just be another liquid? That doesn't make sense.
Well, then you have to break down what makes it a liquid by definition, right? So it's the shape is defined by its container, right? Uh-huh. So that means a gas would not be the opposite because it expands to fill the container. And it can move around. It's a fluid.
The atoms are not... Or the molecules aren't...
They can slide past each other.
Yeah, I was going to say they're not bound to each other, but that doesn't sound right.
You're moving in the direction of a solid. But
solids and gases are... Or solids and liquids are both incompressible. Now, someone might say, I've compressed solids before. It's like, well, what you're really doing is the structure of the solid is sort of like is spongy, and so you're basically like collapsing the framework, you're collapsing the lattice, but the actual matter itself is not getting compressed. Like when you squeeze a sponge, you're not compressing all the individual fibers, you're just smushing the fibers closer to each other and there's less empty space between them. That's how you compress compress a solid.
Can't you say the same of a gas?
Of a gas, yes, but not of a liquid, and not truly of a, because a solid is the actual matter itself doesn't get compressed. It's the
But in a gas it doesn't either, because it's all particles, right?
In a gas there is no structure; it's just a bunch of particles, floating independently of one another. Whereas in a solid, they're actually like bound together in a structure. They're all bonded to each other. And when you compress a solid, when you quote compress something like wood, right? We've all seen wood or other stuff get dented or whatnot, or styrofoam like collapses in your hand pretty good. You're not collapsing that structure. That structure is not getting compressed. It's just that there's little fibers and tendrils of this structure that are now getting smushed closer to each other.
Yeah, because I mean, at some point, if you're changing the molecular structure, molecular bonds and structure, then you're creating a different element or chemical or whatever.
We've all experienced this, right? If you're out in a bunch of people are out in the street and they're walking into a building and then they get crowded inside the building. Well, like the body of the people, or excuse me, like the group of people is getting compressed, but no one person is getting literally squeezed to death. You know what I mean?
Right, but in that analogy, goes back to the point I was making about gas.
Yes, you're right. So
that analogy doesn't work in that situation.
Well, actually, the way that you compress a solid is very similar to how you compress a gas. It's just that in a solid, there's the structure as well. And this is more difficult. This is difficult to describe without diagrams. It's difficult to describe just with words. But So
why use many word when few words do trick?
But okay, so capsaicin, going back to that discussion, capsaicin is, here's another. So I believe it's a solid at room temperature if you can extract it, because it's usually salt. It's usually found dissolved in oil or some liquid within the body of whatever is producing it. So maybe the thing, whatever the opposite is not usually found suspended in a liquid. I don't know what the opposite of that would be. It would have to be, it itself is found alone, because it's not mixed with another chemical like capsaicin is. It's mixed and is suspended within water or oil. So the thing that we find has to be found on its own, no mixing, no solvency, nothing.
Not produced by plants.
Right. So capsaicin is produced by plants. So what's the opposite of being produced by plants?
Producing plants.
No, because they both involve plants. It produces non-natural stuff. Or it produces. So capsaicin is produced. What's the opposite of production? Destruction. And what's the opposite of plants? I would say machinery. Something man-made. What?
Plants.
No, not the opposite of the word. The opposite of the concept.
Slump.
I would say machinery. So the opposite of
capsaicin. It destroys machinery.
It needs to be something that destroys machinery, and it is found on its own. So right now I'm thinking of something like an excavator, or a wrecking ball. So far, wrecking ball. When you touch it, it's probably going to suck heat away from you, unless it's at 90 something degrees, which is possible. But I would say most of the time it's not.
What about one of those industrial like car shredders?
Okay. Yeah. That's a candidate.
It wouldn't trick your brain into making you feel hot because you would be dead.
Well, you don't have to go through it.
Oh, okay. Well, it's not capable of tricking your brain into thinking that you're hot.
Right. And I would say because it's metal, if you put your hand on or any part of your body, unless it's like a hot sunny day, most of the time it's gonna suck heat away from you, and it's gonna actually make you feel cool. It's gonna actually cool you down. Most of the time.
I mean, I feel like a cool guy a lot.
Yeah. Also, bonus. I was gonna say capsaicin is edible, so the opposite has to not be edible. And I would say that one of those industrial shredding machines is certainly not edible.
Depends on how long you got. You ever read about that guy in the Guinness Book of World Records who eats metal stuff?
Yes. Didn't he ate like a whole car or something? Bit by
TV sets, bicycles.
I think he ate a whole bicycle, yeah.
Yeah.
Not in one sitting, but.
Yeah, I think he actually grinds it up and then puts the metal powder in his food.
It's not as fun.
It's still, still a little weird.
But hold on, we're getting pretty close, so. Capsaicin, so edible. What else? Capsaicin is pretty, I would say you usually encounter it in pretty lightweight form. Like if it's a powder or if it's in hot sauce, like you can easily pick it up with your hand. A wrecking ball or industrial shredder, you most certainly can't.
Well, going back to one of the first things we said, it's a chemical. So I think in the truest sense, wrecking ball or a shredder are composed of chemicals, but they are not themselves chemicals.
Ooh, okay. I can dig that. It's not it. The opposite is itself not just another chemical. It has to be something. I guess the only it either has to be a subatomic particle, or it has to be something more complex. Which, in which case, both of them are. The shredder more so.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because it's not just a lump of steel.
Dang. Ben, I think we're the industrial shredder is really it's really looking like the right choice here.
I got one disqualifier, though.
Okay, what's that?
Capsaicin destroys your insides.
Well, the
figuratively,
the shredder would destroy your outsides, but
and your insides.
Well, that's if you ingest it. You don't ingest a shredding machine.
It ingests you.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. And it doesn't even ingest, really. It kind of takes you in and shreds you up. So, like, that's the thing. That's actually another good characteristic. Well, it's related to edible, because I was going to say we ingest capsaicin. Oh,
right.
So whatever the opposite is has to itself
excrete us.
Well, it has to. What's the opposite of what's the word did I? Oh, consume. What did I say? Ingest.
Digest.
What's the opposite of ingesting? I won't say outgesting, because it still involves jesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's the opposite? The conceptual
giving birth.
That's right. You're taking gestation.
Yeah, but you're not consuming resources from the item that went inside your body. You are giving resources to an item that leaves your body.
Ah, but it still involves an exchange of resources.
Oh, wow. I mean,
like, you got to get real fundamental with this thought exercise. So that's what I mean. Like, what
I feel like you could continue. You could continue the thought exercise at any one object or word to infinity here.
Probably.
You just keep assigning attributes, and then, especially when you're breaking down the attributes, and then you break down those attributes.
Yeah.
At every level.
But then that means, like, if you can get through it, it means that your end result is this completely counterintuitive, never would have thought of it, how'd you even come to that conclusion answer.
That's true. That is
true. Which makes it fun. But okay, maybe I'm getting too far down the gestation thing. So what's the opposite of ingestion? I would be okay with outgestion or expulsion, which a shredder does do. But what's the opposite of us? Because we ingest capsaicin, which means that the opposite of capsaicin needs to expel, like, kind of the opposite of, I guess, us.
I mean, you could say that machines are, right?
Yeah, I was actually now thinking maybe it's not the shredder, it's the shredder factory. Because I think the factory shares all the other characteristics of the shredder, but then it also has this expulsion thing.
A factory which produces equipment shredders.
Yes, that is right now is looking like the conceptual opposite of capsaicin.
So if you want to counteract, if you've had too much spicy food and you want to counteract it, walk inside of a factory which produces equipment shredders.
Oh my gosh.
Also, speaking of capsaicin, this is a topic we've had on our list for a while, which is the fact that spicy food, spicy chemicals such as capsaicin or, you know, there are others that create a physiological effect, serve as a defense mechanism to prevent predators from eating plants and give them some semblance of protection, since they're unable to actively fight back. They can passively fight back. So, like, the sense of onions making your eyes water, it's like we're eating the plant equivalent of a porcupine, where it's intended to be unpleasant and to make the experience as awful as possible. And yet somehow we have been like, oh, this is actually interesting. I really like this sensation, at least in moderation. Now I'm going to add that to my food, get a little extra spice. So we're kind of, you know, it's like we like the taste of plant tears, as it were.
Mm-hmm. And is the topic at hand just like an observation of how weird that is?
Well, the fact that most seasoning that we have for food, it comes from a plant and it serves as a defense mechanism for that plant. But then the irony of it is that we're completely undeterred by that defense mechanism and actually prefer it. So we
eat more of it.
Yeah, we harvest and eat more of plants that have interesting flavors.
You know, this thought struck me like just a couple of days ago, where it seems like evolutionarily that would be a downside, right? You as a plant or an animal come up with some defense mechanism to prevent you from being eaten, but then it kind of backfires and now it makes you, you know, preferable, or not you prefer, it makes your predators want to eat you more, which is bad news bears. But at least with people and even some animal species, the predators are now more prone to harvest and like actually cultivate you. And so mm-hmm. any individual is still going to get reaped and killed and die, but the population is protected because the consumers want to make sure that this source of flavor spice is going to stick around. So it actually helps advance your species in a sense.
Yeah. And it's hard to say if that, you know, maybe that's just a happy coincidence. Cause like, I don't see a lot of wild animals eating chili peppers. Maybe there are some, but, like on the opposite side of the coin, you know, plants that produce fruit are doing it with the intention anthropomorphizing here.
Right.
The fruit grows, which attracts animals to eat that fruit and carry the seeds to places that are more distant, so they have a better chance of reproducing, not just falling directly underneath the plant.
Right.
So there is a benefit to having at least a part of the plant consumed, if it contains seeds and can thus help with the reproductive process. But in the case of like capsaicin and things like that, it, as far as I'm aware, a lot of those things, I don't know if you're talking about onions, garlic, I would imagine is in a similar category, peppercorns.
Menthol, I don't, probably from earlier.
Yeah, I don't think those are in any way connected to the reproductive process of that plant. So it's not like, I think were it not for humans, it would provide no insurance or benefit toward reproducing.
Except for the, hey, now I, as an individual plant, am now less likely to die.
Yes,
before correct. I can reproduce. Yep. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Funnily, interestingly enough, birds do not have the, I believe it's all birds. I could be wrong about that part. At least most birds do not have the receptors for capsaicin, so they can eat peppers just fine, and they don't get affected by the spiciness. So it means also birds can't taste spiciness. So I kind of actually feel bad for them.
Except you have a fundamental misunderstanding, because birds aren't real.
Oh, that's right. Well, that's why they can't sense spiciness, because they're robots. Yeah, they're government drones. I forgot. Yeah. Good point.
Yep. Well, at least in my opinion, they're not real.
Nah.
You know, I actually had an interesting conversation with a coworker this week about this exact topic of, you know, whether species survival is about creating a lot of copies or surviving a long time, because we had that discussion a few months back.
Mm-hmm.
And it came up as we were talking about the essentially ironclad global trend that as a nation's GDP per capita increases, birth rates trend downward. There's a negative correlation there. And I mean, it's not strictly based on money, but the correlation is strong there. And so we were just trying to talk through that of like, what is it specifically that causes birth rates to drop as people become more wealthy or have a higher standard of living or become more educated or whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of kicking around some things. And the best explanatory theory that I could come up with is that it's actually more connected to urbanization than anything else. And that if you go back 100 years or 200 years, when most, even the most developed countries were still primarily agrarian, rural, right? They had big cities, but most of the population lived in the country and farmed. It's a well-known situation that farming families had a lot of kids specifically because they needed the help, right? And so mm-hmm. there was a benefit to having a large family. So the cost perhaps of raising children in that environment was low, the benefit was high, and also there was a lot of space. So even if you didn't have a lot of means, you didn't have a ton of neighbors, so you had room to raise a large family. And there was a social aspect of it as well, where because there weren't a lot of people, you didn't necessarily feel overwhelmed by having a large family. If you then contrast that with, you know, as those people moved into the cities, cities kept growing, people left farming as technology improved and started working in factories and stuff like that. They had less physical space. The space that they had was already occupied with other people, so you're like feeling squeezed and stuff like that. There's then less utility for having children, because they're not helping you, you know, plow the field or weed the crops or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you actually are now in a situation where all of your labor is being measured in some form of payment, and you then in turn have to pay to raise your children, whether it's in groceries or rent for a larger apartment or whatever. Or so daycare. Where is it? Or daycare. So whereas in the countryside, really the only cost you had for children was if you had to put up a new room or something or grow more food, but that was within your control, and it wasn't, you didn't have to hand that over to someone else. Mm. Whereas in the city, everything that you have to do on behalf of your child is handing over some of your money and therefore labor to someone else. And so you see that transaction cost, if you will, for raising a child.
Yeah.
Whereas it was basically invisible when people lived in the rural areas.
And your point about how I think a big deterrent is that kids, and this is might sound a little mean, but kids don't offer an inherent benefit to the family. There is, besides you just having a kid to have a kid, there is no monetary benefit to the family. They're only another mouth to feed, another thing to spend money on to raise, and another thing to devote your time to, right? Just raising mm-hmm. a kid takes time, and a lot of people would prefer to spend their time doing leisurely stuff or things that they want to work on. So why would they have a kid? Whereas when you're, you know, lower GDP, having a kid doesn't have those drawbacks because, yeah, I mean, you still have to pay to raise them. But as you said, you usually will put them to work getting more money for what crops you can raise or livestock you can raise. And so they sort of pay for themselves. You don't have to generally do daycare because the family all works on site at home on their farm. It's not like you have to take your kid and go drop them off so you can go into the office because there's no kids allowed there.
Right. Yeah, and that would be maybe one nuance is that even in urban areas, the tendency is that lower income or families would have more children than higher income families. And that component doesn't get fully explained by my theory, but I think you are starting to connect some of those dots a little bit.
Explain the part that your theory doesn't, the component that your theory doesn't explain. I didn't quite catch it.
That even within, like, so my theory was saying essentially that as people moved into cities, their family size shrank. But then, so that could explain the general trend toward smaller families and lower birth rates. But then within cities, actually, this is just highlighting that there's multiple contributing factors that drive the birth rate.
Mm-hmm.
Because that the urbanization could describe the macro trend pretty well. But then within a city, there or within urban areas, where you would say, oh, everyone here should now have smaller families.
Yep.
They still, on average, have smaller families than they would have historically in the country. But there still tends to be a distribution where the lower income families have more children than the higher income families.
You ever seen Idiocracy?
No, but it's on my list.
The gist, and this isn't spoiling anything, the gist is that 500 years in the future, like, everybody in the U.S. has like an IQ of 10. And the reason why is because all the smart people are like, well, we don't want to have a kid because it's, you know, our we're trying to focus on our careers right now. And then it's like, you know, we're just not like really compatible like with each other as parents. And then they end up like splitting up. And so then they end up not having any kids. And then but then like the dumb people are just, you know, having sex without protection. They're not thinking things through. So they just end up having a bunch of kids. And then as you just repeat this process over and over and over again throughout the generations, it's all the stupid people who are breeding and all of the wealthy and intellectual people who aren't. And so, you know, do the math, the world eventually gets populated by a bunch of dumb people. And that's the gist. So applying that here, it could just be that the wealthier, and I'm assuming maybe, well, definitely better off folks. I kind of lost my train of thought. I'm a little worried I was coming to the conclusion that poor people are dumb, ergo they have more kids. But that's not the point I was trying to make, but I did lose the point that I was trying to make.
Well, I think there is people who have the opportunity and the capability to develop a marketable skill set and you know, increase their standard of living over time are going to do that, right? They might not always have the opportunity right away, but eventually when the opportunity presents itself, that's going to happen. So there certainly is an element of those who just don't have better options are kind of stuck. And there certainly are some who they aren't paying any attention to the implications of what having a child brings to their life, right? It's just not on their radar. But the counterpoint to what you were saying is that I don't know any of the details here, but I don't believe intelligence or IQ is nearly that strongly connected to genetic predisposition.
Sure.
I think there's a lot of it that's nutritional based and what environment are you raised in. So it could appear genetic if you continue to have poor developmental conditions generation after generation, but I don't think there's a strong tie between genetics and IQ.
Well, if you're raised, like, let's say we start off with two parents that are intellectually challenged, then any kids they raise are going to be at a disadvantage because they're being raised in an intellectually challenged home, which means that when they're adults, good chance that they're intellectually challenged and the process just sort of repeats itself. But I think the point I was trying to make before I lost it is that maybe the more wealthy, quote, intelligent people are more, there is the balance that we were talking about earlier, where now children are more of a liability in your career or your, I guess just your career or your maybe academic pursuits, right? Like if you're getting a doctorate and you need to go through undergrad and then get a master's and then go for your PhD, that's a lot of time in school that you have to pay for. That is not the best time to have a kid. So a lot of those folks are going to be much more likely to hold off on having kids until later on, whereas somebody who maybe didn't go through college or just went to undergrad, they're going to start having kids earlier. And even if they don't have more kids than the person who pursued a PhD, they're having kids earlier, which means that their kids will have kids earlier than the other PhD kids. And then they end up reproducing faster.
Yeah, generation to generation. Yeah.
Right.
The other element, though, is that, and this is what I was getting at earlier, is that at least in our society, lower income jobs tend to be those where there's no special skill required. It's just manual labor, right? You need someone to do something that doesn't require a lot of training or thought or effort. Well, a lot of physical effort probably, but you can kind of just put anyone in that position.
Right.
And so in that work environment, there is an advantage to brute force still, right? Sort of like on the farm where having more kids meant you could get more work done. If you're working in a service industry or something that requires manual labor, you know, if you've got extra kids and when they're, you know, teenagers or whatever, they can go to work and they can actually earn a wage and help support the family. So there's still utility, I would say, in having children because they multiply your labor capability. But when you get into those highly skilled jobs, the ones that tend to pay more, there a child cannot contribute until they have that qualification.
Which often won't come until early or even kind of partway through adulthood.
Right. And by that point, they're in their own household anyway.
Right.
So there's essentially no household utility in having more children.
And
it's purely a fulfillment thing, not a we need this kind of thing.
Yes. And I was going to even say to get the kids through the training for the affluent or for the skilled jobs, that the parents, certainly not always, but a lot of the time, end up paying for the college or at least helping. So another liability, another, you know, sink of money and resources that they're not going to get back. That's not the case where if your kids, one, just work more menial jobs, right? You don't need to go through school to flip burgers at McDonald's. Your parents don't need to pay for it. Now, I would counter your argument with nobody's having kids with the intention of in 14 to 15 years, they'll be able to get a minimum wage job and help support us. Let's have a kid for that reason. You know, whereas back on the farm, that was not the case. They needed more farm hands, so they had more kids.
Yeah, but I what I would say is no one's having kids for that reason, but they'll muck through the early years, right? And then there is still some payoff to that to some extent.
Or there could be. But I'll there agree
could,
that,
there could be.
Yeah. I agree that there's potential. I wouldn't say from what I know, I guess, which is, I mean, I only have my family's example. That's not the case, but.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of it's a cultural thing. You know, because there are some cultures where it's like, hey, if you're 13 or 14 years old, you go get a part-time job or a full-time job and work to support the family. Mm. Or you know, like the family owns a restaurant and they're at the restaurant, you know, bussing tables or washing dishes or whatever.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. Family business.
Saving them labor, even if they're not being directly compensated by the family.
Yeah, that's a good point. I forgot about family businesses, which I know my granddad owned a restaurant, and I know at least my uncle worked there. I believe all the kids did to some extent. But I know for sure my uncle worked there. I don't know if like he just, if his dad, if my granddad paid him like any other worker and he kept his own money to do with what he will, I think he did. I think he was mentioning about getting paychecks and stuff. So, but he was also kind of early, later high school, college age at the time. So maybe that's not a great example, but I was going to say there's a show called Freaks and Geeks. I'm sure some of our listeners have heard of it. Pretty cult following show, but there is a scene where there's a high school student and he's talking with his mom about going to work so that he can get a paycheck to help with his, I think it's his dad's like medical bills or something. So that's an example in somewhat recent times. Since urbanization.
There's actually a documentary about a guy who was, his father passed away in a tragic accident, and he was adopted by his stepfather, and then his stepfather was having needed a heart replacement, and so this guy set about trying to raise money to support his dad's heart replacement, and so he tried to like one up Evel Knievel by holding a stunt to jump over a bunch of school buses. And the whole thing was covered on the local AM radio station about his fundraising efforts. And then at the end, you know, he was able to raise enough money and get the heart replacement surgery.
What you're talking about.
why are you laughing, Jack? This is so serious.
Oh my God. I've only seen it like twice, like 10 years apart. So it took me a second.
You're like, wait, this sounds really familiar.
It sounds vaguely familiar here. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
He's talking about the movie Hot Rod, by the way, people, if you didn't know.
Yeah, it's actually a documentary about Andy Samberg's life story with his stepfather Frank.
Oh my gosh. Never sneak up on a man that's been in a chemical fire. I can't remember if that's the exact line, but it was something
side note, that is one of my, I don't get to do it very often, but it's one of my favorite things to like deadpan give the plot of a movie as if it actually happened and see if people notice or how long it takes them to notice.
I'm pretty proud of myself because that's not a movie that, you know, it's not like a Tommy Boy or a Dumb and Dumber where I pretty much know that movie backwards and front.
What was the detail that finally where you had the aha moment?
The Evel Knievel thing, that wasn't that did it. I think it was that, and then the local AM radio station. Like, oh, I was like, okay, this sounds like the plot to a movie. And then I was like, Evel Knievel, stepdad. Wait a minute.
I haven't drinking green tea all day. The last time I had the chance to do something like that was actually in a work training event. I think I've told you this story, Jack, but I don't remember. And it was kind of something to do with like innovation and team building. And as part of it, we were doing an exercise where each person had to answer the question of like, what is humanity's single greatest invention or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people were talking about the printing press or the internet or the wheel, blah, blah, blah. And I said that I thought our most impressive feat was extracting the DNA of dinosaurs from amber and then cloning them.
We're talking about this.
And I just talked about it as if the events actually occurred. And it took people a minute and they started laughing.
Did somebody say, well, life finds a way?
No one said that.
Oh,
no. I didn't get the sense that there was anyone else in the room who's like a true movie buff. Like there are a few people who clearly got the reference, but yeah, not big Jurassic Park fans.
Mm. Oh, that's too bad. I watched that movie and The Lost World a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
Those movies.
I didn't watch either of them until I was an adult. Like,
Oh,
probably
wow.
only like 6 years ago, maybe.
Oh, dang. Did you ever see the third one?
The third one.
There's Jurassic Park 1, 2, and 3, and then I think there was a long break. There might have been a 4 before they did the more recent reboots.
I thought 3 was the recent reboot. I thought it was Jurassic Park and then Lost World and then the reboot.
No, Jurassic Park 3 came out in 2000, I think, 99 or 2000, around there.
I
It's
don't.
of the original three, it's generally the least popular.
Yeah. I don't remember if I watched it or not because I think I wanted to go watch the first of the reboot series. And so I watched a couple weeks beforehand, I watched Jurassic Park and Lost World to like prep myself.
Yeah.
And I don't
Ooh.
remember if I watched the third one.
Jurassic Park 3. So I really liked it, as particularly as a kid, because one, it had like a pterodactyl scene where they're like in a, like in zoos, they have like the kind of
Oh,
like the
yeah.
big dome cages you can go into and see all the birds.
Yeah.
It was like that, but like this
Aviary.
monster. Yeah, it was a monstrous aviary, and it was housing pterodactyls, and that was a pretty cool scene. And then also, shortly before the movie came out, they had I think they had new dis there was a newly discovered dinosaur that kind of rivaled the T-Rex for like size and ferocity and strength. And it kind of looked more sleek, had a longer, thinner snout, and it had like a big fin on its back. And then they had a big fight scene between a T-Rex and that thing in the movie. So I was just really excited to see
Yeah.
the new like competitor to the T-Rex like on the screen. I remember that. So but yeah,
As
no, I liked it.
you describe it, I think I did watch it because I vaguely remember those scenes.
Okay. Yeah, that happens in episode 3, or the Jurassic Park 3, whatever you want to call it.
What if we made like a crossover universe where we mash together like the plots and characters of franchises? So it's like Star Wars Episode One with Jurassic Park with I'm trying to decide if it either be the first movie from the Hobbit trilogy or the Fellowship of the Ring. But you get my drift, right? There's like bring franchise universes together based on which their episode number.
No, I'm not following. What you mean?
Oh, okay. Well,
Go
never mind.
to more. It sounds interesting.
Well,
What do you
so
mean
like
bring him together? Like Samwise Gamgee, Luke Skywalker, and a velociraptor, like all walk into a bar?
yeah, pretty much. Yeah, like no, maybe Luke Luke could be riding a dinosaur instead of a tauntaun, and then they are trying to help Samwise escape from a black rider or something.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
I'm trying to think of other series that are long enough to fit into that. You could do Indiana Jones. You could
Pirates
do
of the Caribbean.
Fast and the Furious, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Because that's like, older technology, but there's also magic, like ghosts and haunts that. So I was going to say, obviously, whichever, like the sci-fi genre is going to win out because they have space travel, they got ships, they got laser guns, they have the Force in the case of Star Wars. So like any fight, they're going to win hands down. Like T-Rex
But
coming
then,
after Han and Chewie's just going to like laser crossbow the thing in the face and they'll move on.
yeah, but then maybe like Darth Vader is fighting Luke. And then a T-Rex stomps out of the forest and bites him
Can
before
you
he
imagine
realizes it's there.
Darth Vader? Okay, first off, Darth Vader would totally see it coming. He has the Force.
Doesn't make him omnipotent or omniscient.
No, but he would. They'd like the he would have a much better sense of his surroundings than to let a T-Rex sneak up on him.
I don't know. Maybe T-Rexes are like outside of the forest, like the Salamari from the
Ooh.
expanded universe.
But it would be cool to see either Darth Vader riding a T-Rex into battle, or maybe they have a T-Rex be a pilot of a TIE fighter. So you just see like this giant dinosaur crammed into the cockpit, wearing like the helmet and like the goggles, and like the little arms are trying to move the joystick to fly the plane or fly the TIE fighter.
Or hear me out. We get the origin story for Jar Jar, who is like the first dinosaur clone that they didn't quite have correct. And he turned out sideways, you know, and then he gets launched into the Star Wars universe.
Oh my gosh, that'd be hilarious. Can you imagine now, like Sam Neill, like in the scene from Jurassic Park where the eggs hatch and come on, you can do it, little guy. Like in the lab, remember that?
Yeah.
They help him take the shell, and then Jar Jar's little head, Lisa, I'm Jar Jar Binks. And then they all just like recoil in horror.
Like, no, kill it, kill it.
Kill it, kill it.
I'm imagining now like some Hollywood brain trust, like taking all these franchises, laying out their plots on like a timeline, and then doing some meta analysis of like each episode. So it's like, okay, this episode one is about, you know, father son story. This episode one is about, you know, the discovery of, yeah, whatever it is. Right. And so they break it down into all these story elements and then reassemble it into this cohesive narrative that they then stitch, like have connective tissue between episode one to two to three, and actually make it a new meta series.
Hmm.
It's like the best, what'd you call it? Like the best serial story or something like that.
Best, what do you mean serial story?
Well, like being told in multiple episodes across multiple films.
Oh. Multiple episodes and multiple films?
I mean, what, like multiple films being multiple installments or episodes of the series.
Okay. I think I feel you.
Did you ever watch the Ultimate Showdown Flash video back in the early 2000s?
That's like the all the different. Yes, I don't remember watching it when like it was OG around, but maybe you or someone else showed it to me within the last few years.
Yeah. So the premise, for those who aren't familiar, it's back when like Flash animation was all the rage and the Homestar Runner era, around that time, there was a Flash video called The Ultimate Showdown. And it was essentially this mashup of all these celebrities and superheroes that end up in this giant battle. Mr. Rogers is the one who emerges victorious over all the others, like Chuck Norris and Darth Vader.
Batman's in there, Godzilla.
Batman, yep. Kobe, Shaq, yeah. Abraham Lincoln with the machete. Anyway, that's what I'm imagining it would end up like. The hard part would be, it would essentially be a story with only leads. Right. Mm. Because you like the side characters would be leads from another story.
Right.
So you wouldn't be able to have any like supporting actors, really. That'd be tough. All right. Let's make it. We got to find somebody to fund this mega project.
It'd be like a mashup, or there's a maybe kind of like a battle royale, because like I feel like in battle royales, like in like I know they had one in Dragon Ball Super where it's like all of these, like, you know, the strongest person from these different worlds. It's mm-hmm. like they are the main character of the world, like everybody, you know, no one can stop them. But then in this battle royale, you know, there's some of them that get eliminated pretty quick, so they were side characters in this best of the best. It would be kind of like that, where like, yeah, Luke might be a side character and Mario might be the lead.
Which, the more we're talking about this, the more I could actually see some studio like Amazon Prime or Netflix or whoever getting excited about and then just absolutely butchering it.
Yep. Where you would have to be ridiculous. You would have to be make it just over the top dumb.
But I feel like they would just, it would be 100% CGI and they would just get some big name actors and they would, they'd think that's all you need.
Yeah. You know what else would make it almost probably impossible to do well is all the IP. All the IP shenanigans between all these different not universes, but the actual different IPs, like different owners of all the characters that have to agree and get paid, you know,
right?
That'd be redonkulous. Just the royalties alone would bankrupt the studio.
It'd be like, the Star Wars Disney is getting paid, you know, 3%. We're only getting 2.5%. Well, now we want 3%. Now we want 3.5%. It would be brutal. But if we, wait. Okay, we need to file this idea away for whatever it is, 75 years from now, when all of this IP goes into the public domain. Actually, some of it will be less than 75 years, but we could limit it to stuff that came out before 2000, and then we could start filming in 2075.
Let's go. By then, we could probably just have AI generate the movie for us. We won't even need actors or a studio or a production team.
Yeah, I think we've solved it. Actually, we should just not try to fix any problems right now. We should just hold on to them and have fun right now until AI can solve them in the future.
I like it.
I think I just fixed our AI problem.
Mm-hmm.
I like it. It's like the having yourself frozen on ice, you know, until they develop some way to clone people or extend lifespans or whatever.
Just I like it.
Wait for AI to do it.
Let's go. Like, just lean into it, man.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of AI. Just let it happen.
Except that we're all just letting it happen by not doing anything. So then that future actually never comes to fruition.
Dang it.
Which, if you didn't want AI in the first place, is great. So whichever way you're leaning, you could get on board with this idea. Okay, well, that was quite the tangential trip we went on there.
It was. We discussed a lot today.
Yeah, we did. A lot of things that I never would have put together at the beginning, from South Park to what's the opposite of a word to capsaicin and plant defense mechanisms. And was that the last topic before we get on to this whole mashup thing?
I can't remember. My things just go in and out of my brain.
They go in and out of your brain.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I think this is a good stopping point. I feel content with what we covered. Good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd like to hear from you, listeners. What franchises did we miss to include in our mashup? If you've got an essential that we missed, let us know. And as always, you can sign up to be a guest or to submit topics for us to add to our queue. Just use the link to the Google form in the episode description or in the podcast bio. So we'll end there for today. Until next time, take care.